Alicia Sender-Zucker, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Policy and Research Coordinator at the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, which won the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Steve DeSev. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, and Andriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Tomorrow we'll be speaking about with Heather McGee about the sum of us. To sign up for our daily digest, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe, wear a mask.
David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Portland Folk Music Society, in collaboration with Musicians in Solidarity, is thrilled to announce this year's Sing Time Frolics Festival, online and real-time, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, March 26th through 28th, with guest artists Gordon Bach and Carol Roll, Stephanie Ann Johnson, Beth Wood, Lauren Sheehan, and Jermaine Malone, plus over 30 workshops and song circles. Come to sing or just come to listen. To register, go to portlandfolkmusic.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's getting ready to open up vaccine eligibility as new cases of COVID continue to rise. Why deaths in nursing homes have brought more tragedies in communities of color during the pandemic. And a type of cancer is showing up more and in younger people. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 18th, 2021. I am Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us. The Oregon Health Authority reports 393 new confirmed and presumptive COVID-19 cases and 4 new deaths today. The past week, the state's seen a trend of more new cases, but fewer deaths and hospitalizations. Meantime, Oregon is getting ready to let all adults be eligible for COVID vaccines as of May 1st. On Wednesday, Oregon Governor Kay Brown said they were looking forward to partnering with the federal government to ramp up vaccine supplies to state health providers to achieve the nationwide deadline set by the Biden-Harris administration. The Oregon Health Authority echoed Brown's assurance that for all adults in the state, vaccine doses will be available as intended. Previous updates from the OHA stated they were waiting on a commitment from Washington that adequate supplies of vaccine would be made available to the state to achieve mass inoculations by the 1st of May. Now, to put that in perspective, officials from the Oregon Convention Center vaccination site estimate that by the end of March, they'll be giving out about 1,100 shots per hour to recipients. Currently, the vaccination site is giving out about 850 shots per hour, and that's up from 750 shots per hour last week. OHA is hoping to speed the next round of eligible populations for vaccination on or before March 29th, which will include migrant and seafood workers, wildland firefighters, houseless communities, and those age 45 and up with underlying health issues. Some frontline workers are concerned that their efforts to secure a dose will put them in competition with every other adult come May. They include grocery store workers who have remained open, operating, and engaged with the public throughout the pandemic. OHA Director Patrick Allen said earlier this week that efforts to accelerate Oregon's vaccination timeline are set in place, provided the doses are available. Brown's expressed a similar intention, saying on March 12th, "If the doses are there, I have every intention of utilizing all available state and federal resources to achieve universal eligibility." In the Portland area, many hotels that have stood empty during the pandemic are now offering housing access. As Eric Tegedoff reports, Portland and Multnomah County have now transitioned about 300 people from congregate care to hotels.
The pandemic could mark a shift in how people experiencing homelessness are housed. In Portland and across the country, emptied-out hotels from drops in tourism have offered a unique chance to provide housing, especially to people living in congregate shelters. Isabel Whitcomb wrote about this for Yes Magazine. She says folks share living spaces in shelters, increasing their chances of contracting COVID-19.
Many cities are realizing that this program worked so well and had so many additional benefits aside from preventing coronavirus outbreaks. Why not continue it after the pandemic?
Whitcomb notes that people who are unhoused faced health challenges even before the pandemic. A 2018 study found mortality rates were 3 to 11 times higher for unhoused populations. In October, Oregon legislators approved Project Turnkey, a $65 million investment to turn hotels into permanent supportive housing. Portland and Multnomah County have been prioritizing medically vulnerable people who are at high risk of COVID-19 and transitioned about 300 people from congregate shelters to motels. Portland resident Jeff Smith has been unhoused for nearly a decade and fighting thyroid cancer for the past 5 years. Smith was becoming less engaged in his medical treatment, but a few months into the pandemic, he got the chance to move into his own hotel room.
I had already given up. It took me a long time to get to this place to where I could fight for my life again.
Whitcomb says there's anecdotal evidence of positive outcomes from these programs during the pandemic. Housing provides a private place where it's easier for people to take care of their own hygiene, store medications, and look after their mental health. Importantly, Whitcomb says these spaces also offer dignity.
Over and over again, I heard from people and I heard anecdotes about the potential they offer to kind of take a breath, rest, and then access those resources that people need to get back on their feet.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden has started holding hearings on the Senate Finance Committee about the tremendous loss of life surrounding nursing homes since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. And he says those deaths are falling most heavily on communities of color.
Americans are beginning to feel encouraged, and yet so many families, hundreds of thousands spread across the country, are unable to share in the sense of uplift because they are mourning loved ones that they have lost. Over the last year, more than 175,000 long-term care residents and workers, including 130,000 living and working in federally certified nursing homes, have died of this terrible disease. They were at the center of a collision of mismanagement. In too many nursing homes, even before the pandemic, there was chronic understaffing, slipshod plans for infection control, and abuse and neglect of vulnerable patients. When COVID-19 arrived, the Trump administration came up small by withholding data, failing to distribute protective equipment, and issuing guidance that put seniors in harm's way. This was a systemic, nationwide failure and it will be challenging to fix. Members can start by agreeing on basic facts. First, what's true of the overall population is true in our nursing homes. Black, Latino, and Native Americans are suffering the worst of COVID-19. A recent study authored by Professor Konetska, one of the witnesses joining the committee, found that the loss of life was more than 3 times higher in nursing homes with the highest proportions of Black and Latino residents compared to facilities with mostly white residents. Black Americans and immigrants also make up a disproportionate share of nursing home staff. Often, they get paid low wages. More than 500,000 of them have confirmed cases of COVID-19, and thousands have died. There's also real concern that COVID-19 will continue to circulate among those communities where vaccines aren't readily available or where uptake is lower. These disparities in COVID-19 deaths are the result of generations of inequity in society and healthcare. Undoing it is going to take a lot of work by this committee, and I know colleagues feel very strongly about getting it done. Second, the previous administration actively impeded efforts to address long-running problems in nursing homes. You could fill a library with the watchdog reports calling public attention to these issues. Incidents of abuse and neglect, chronic understaffing, horrendous living conditions, inadequate emergency preparedness. This was an industry-wide failure also when it came to infection control. Instead of addressing these questions, the Trump administration dramatically reduced the penalties for failing to meet basic protective federal standards. They went out of their way to undermine a chance for real accountability. When states rushed to develop COVID policies, some followed Trump administration guidance that encouraged nursing homes to accept patients regardless of whether they tested positive for the virus. When the pandemic was spreading and nursing homes desperately needed PPE, the Trump administration sent out shipments that reportedly included loose, unusable gloves, hospital gowns that resembled trash bags, and defective masks. The Trump administration did not want people to know about what was going on in nursing homes. Our colleague Senator Casey and I spent months pressuring and pleading with them to release comprehensive data. The Trump administration stonewalled. They dithered, they delayed before they finally began to relate. As of now, there still is no reliable data on COVID in nursing homes before May 1st of last year because of the Trump administration's stonewalling. The terrible impact of COVID-19 on seniors in long-term care is not a red state or a blue state issue. It is a nationwide tragedy. Specifically, if you look at the 10 states where nursing homes have been hit the hardest, it's 5 Republican-led states and 5 Democratic-led states. So the reality is long-term care residents in all 50 states were incredibly vulnerable to a pandemic like COVID-19 for long-standing reasons, but the Trump administration worked harder to protect their unscrupulous friends and management than to improve the safety of residents. The Biden administration is working to turn things around. It starts with ramping up vaccinations, creating strike teams of highly trained workers, going to go into nursing homes and identify the safety risks. This hearing isn't the first or the last time the committee is going to be digging into nursing home safety. We're going to continue to work with members, all members of this committee, because looking after the well-being of America's seniors is at the heart of our jurisdiction. I feel personally strongly about this after my 7 years as co-director of the Oregon Gray Panthers.
Again, that was Oregon Senator and Senate Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden at a hearing about nursing home deaths during the pandemic. The European Medicines Agency is now saying that AstraZeneca's COVID vaccine is safe and effective. The agency investigated after 13 European countries suspended the use of the vaccine because of a possible link to blood clots. But now scientists say it's not associated with a higher risk of clots, so Italy, Spain, and Germany say they will resume using it. Meantime, President Biden's administration is planning to send about 4 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to Mexico and Canada. The AstraZeneca vaccine has not yet been authorized for use in the U.S. Jury selection in the murder trial of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin continues, with the 10th juror seated today. Chauvin will stand trial for the murder of George Floyd, whose death sparked worldwide racial justice protests in 2020. The jury selection process has proven contentious, As the defense maintains that the case is not about race, potential jurors with lived experience in police violence have been excluded as a result. Samantha Hong Long with the Racial Reckoning Project has the latest.
With jury selection for the murder trial of Derek Chauvin underway, there are continued concerns of what a fair jury pool would really look like, especially if the lived experiences of Black people aren't represented. On Wednesday, potential juror number 76, a Black man, was struck from the jury pool, even after he repeatedly insisted he could be fair and impartial.
The law presumes Mr. Chauvin innocent of these charges. Do you understand that?
Yes, sir.
Do you agree with that?
Yes, sir.
Can you apply that?
Yes, sir.
Will you apply that?
Yes, sir.
Attorneys for the defense claimed the potential juror was inherently biased due to his personal experiences with the police. The state's attorneys said they were disappointed and that he was just sharing his lived experience. Jonathan McCullen, president of the Minnesota Justice Coalition, says the candidate's lived experiences could have provided valuable insight during deliberations.
You expect that you would have a jury that would truly represent the people, and I don't think that that's what they're looking for. I think that they're looking for a jury that represents Derek Chauvin.
Judge Cahill excused two jurors that had previously been seated for the trial. They said that news of the $27 million settlement for the George Floyd family had affected their opinions on the case. As of Wednesday afternoon, nine jurors have been seated for the trial. Judge Cahill continues to consider the defense's request to relocate and delay the trial. He says he will make a decision by Friday. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Samantha Hong Long.
The Oregon State University Board of Trustees voted to put OSU President F. King Alexander on probation until June 1st. This comes after a meeting in which students and faculty shared harsh criticism. People called in demanding Alexander's resignation because of what they say was his mishandling of sexual misconduct by a football coach at his former employer, Louisiana State University. The board issued a statement condemning sexual violence and misconduct. Alexander also apologized to victims and said he was working to rebuild trust after the fallout. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, Ear to the Streets of Portland. Then at 10, the Autonomy Hour. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy, down to a low of 44. Tomorrow's weather, clouds, occasional rain, and a high of 54. Those clouds continue over the weekend with highs in the 50s. Today in history, on this date in 1922, Mahatma Gandhi was sentenced to 6 years in prison for civil disobedience in India. Our quote of the day is from Gandhi, who said, "Strength does not come from winning. Your struggles develop your strengths. When you go through hardships and decide not to surrender, that is strength." A Georgia sheriff's captain is facing a deluge of criticism for characterizing the actions of Robert Air Long as having a really bad day. Long is the 21-year-old officers have charged with killing 8 people in Atlanta. 6 of them were women of Asian descent. Captain Jay Baker with the Cherokee County Sheriff's Department said at a news conference that investigators interviewed Long and that, quote, "he was pretty much fed up and kind of at the end of his rope. And yesterday was a really bad day for him, and this is what he did." The backlash against Baker grew louder after many news outlets showed that he had previously shared images on social media of T-shirts that bore a racist slogan about China and the coronavirus. We are learning more about the shooting victims. Joshi Tan was a massage therapist and the owner of at least 2 salons in the Atlanta area. Delana Ashley Yan was the mother of a 14-year-old son and 8-month-old daughter. She worked at a restaurant and had gone to the spa with her husband, who was not injured in the shooting. Paul Andre Michels was the owner of an electric company and an Army veteran. He'd been married for 2 decades. Elcias Hernandez Ortiz, the only survivor, was a mechanic who immigrated from Guatemala 10 years ago. He was seriously wounded and called his wife telling her he was shot. He's been hospitalized with multiple gunshot wounds. Republican attorneys general are suing over the stimulus plan. Law professor Jack Chin talks about America's history of anti-Asian violence. And the House Judiciary Committee is meeting to address rising discrimination against Asian Americans. With more on these stories, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
It appears a shooter, age 21, a white male, first went to a spa called Young's Asian Massage. The fact that he went to that one with that title gives you a clue as to what he was thinking.
Democratic Representative Judy Chu of California, chair of the House Asian American and Pacific Islander Caucus, is urging action in the wake of the Tuesday shooting in Atlanta that left at least 8 people dead, most of them Asian women. A House Judiciary hearing today will address the rise in anti-Asian American hate and discrimination. Chu urged people to consider her own anti-hate crime bill and called for a national day to speak out against AAPI hate on March 26th. Chu said a big reason behind a spike in hate crimes against the AAPI community amid the pandemic is the former president's language coupling the virus with racist terms.
President Trump clearly stoked the flames of xenophobia against AAPIs with his rhetoric. And what we saw is the result of that.
Stomp AAPI Hate, an advocacy group, says it has received nearly 3,800 reports of hate incidents across the U.S. since March 2020. In previous years, there were about 100 incidents annually. President Biden said on Wednesday he knows, quote, Asian Americans are very concerned. But he will wait to comment on the motivation of the Atlanta shooter till the investigation is complete. UC Davis law professor Jack Chin says the recent wave of anti-AAPI violence sadly reflects what Asians have faced in the U.S.
There's a long history of anti-Asian violence and of treating Asians as foreigners. It goes back 150 years, and it's never really gone away.
Chin says if the Chinese government or a Chinese institution was responsible for COVID, then they should be held accountable.
But what does that have to do with me? What does that have to do with the people in the United States who weren't in China, had nothing to do with this pandemic?
A new intelligence report on the rising threat of domestic terrorism says racially motivated extremists, such as white supremacists, are most likely to conduct mass casualty attacks against civilians. The Biden administration report to Congress also predicts the threat of militias targeting law enforcement and government will increase. Biden requested the assessment after the Capitol riot. More than 20 Republican state attorneys general are threatening to take action against the Biden administration over the stimulus plan, claiming the measure unconstitutionally puts limits on their ability to lower taxes. The bill includes a provision saying federal dollars must be spent on relief efforts, not to cut state or local taxes. Finally, the Senate confirmed Katherine Tai as the new U.S. Trade Representative, the first Asian American woman and woman of color to hold the position. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum.
A report shows young women in some parts of the U.S. are at increased risk for colon cancer. Michaela Savitt reports many of these counties are in the Northeast and Midwest, and women of color are especially impacted.
It's Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and health experts are sounding the alarm over higher fatality rates in young women. A study published in December 2020 shows early-onset colorectal cancer in young women has been linked to such factors as lack of physical activity and obesity. Dr. Rizwana Chowdhury with Johns Hopkins University says healthcare disparities contribute to late detection and a worse prognosis.
We know that African Americans do have a higher incidence and mortality from colorectal cancer. So one is adequate healthcare, reaching a physician to discuss symptoms, coming in to get their screening.
According to the study, Black women living in hotspot states like Maryland accounted for 23% of early onset colorectal cancer cases, compared to 14% in other states. Rates of early-onset colon cancer among white women were about the same, no matter whether they lived in an area classified as a hotspot. The study cites not only low physical activity and poor diet, but socioeconomic status as a contributor to colon cancer prevalence, and women are more likely to have lower incomes than men. Dr. Chowdhury says these are warning signs worth paying attention to.
It kind of brings to our attention, let's not ignore symptoms that we might have in the past because maybe it could be more heightened because we're sensitive to the fact that something may be going on in our environment. There are other folks in our location who are now being diagnosed with earlier onset colorectal cancer.
She adds colon cancer is more treatable at an early stage, but the pandemic has led to a major drop in preventative screenings, down 86% nationwide, according to electronic health records. I'm Michaela Savitt for Public News Service.
New research shows that colon cancer survival rates in younger women are strongly linked to where those women live And this comes as this type of cancer is showing up more frequently in younger adults. So I asked Dr. David Greenwald, the president of the American College of Gastroenterology, about these trends.
Colorectal cancer is largely a preventable disease. If we find polyps and we remove them before they turn into cancer, prevent colorectal cancer. If we find it early, it's treatable. And so the mantra for colorectal cancer is that it is preventable, treatable, and therefore beatable. It's unfortunately the third most common cancer in both men and women in the United States. 1 in 23 men and 1 in 25 women, so about 4% of the population, develops colorectal cancer in their lifetime. And much of that happens in the later years of life. Colorectal cancer is becoming more common in young adults. We don't really understand exactly why, but it's clear. The study that you refer to was published in Clinical and Translational Gastroenterology, and it showed that women who were diagnosed with early onset colorectal cancer had a greater risk of dying from that disease depending on their county of residence. And I don't really think it's the county or the geographic area that's so important, as the higher rates of poverty, the lack of health insurance, and access to fewer primary care physicians in those counties in the United States.
I have spoken to some doctors regarding colorectal cancer who say that they're also seeing this in men, younger men too.
Yeah, correct. So the study that you referred to did single out women, but there are other studies that show the same trend in both men and women. And again, I would think that the factors that are important here are access to health care and lack of health insurance. And of course, that's going to apply equally to both men and women.
Can you tell me about the situation in Oregon and in Washington?
Yeah. So again, colorectal cancer screening rates are the most important thing, because most colorectal cancer is preventable if we can screen for it and take out precancerous polyps. So there's good news for Washington and Oregon. The latest data we have is from 2018, and 72% of the population in both Washington and Oregon have been screened, and that compares to a national average of about 69%. We've set a target in this country of 80% screening, so we still have a ways to go, both in the United States and in your area in Washington and Oregon, but we've made great progress in the past 15 to 20 years. One other important thing in Oregon and Washington, which is seen all around the country, is disparities in screening. So, for example, in colorectal cancer screening test use in Oregon and Washington, 70% of Caucasians have reported being screened, as compared to, say, 53% of Hispanics and Latinos. We need to close those disparities gaps.
As far as screenings, what ages do you think it should begin?
So that's a great question, Annette. So the American College of Gastroenterology published guidelines that have changed the recommended age for average risk individuals to be screened for colorectal cancer, decreased that age from 50 to 45. And this is in line with other recommendations that have been published over the past 2 years, first by the American Cancer Society and also by the Citywide Coalition, Cancer Control Coalition in New York. Other groups are working on similar changes to their guidelines. So the age to begin screening is 45 for average risk people.
Some doctors are offering different options. You can have the FIT test, which you do at home, or you can have a colonoscopy. Obviously, there are advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the key point there is the best screening test is the one that gets done. So there are a variety of choices. We call this shared decision making between a healthcare provider and an individual patient as to which test will fit them best. And the options include colonoscopy, which is really a one-step test, meaning that you go in for your test. If the healthcare provider finds a polyp, for example, they remove the polyp, and then you're done with your screening and prevention at that point. The others are two-step tests. So this involves stool-based testing, looking for either blood or abnormal cells in the stool that might indicate the presence of polyps or cancer. And if those are positive, then they're also followed up with a colonoscopy. The best screening test is the one that actually gets done by the patient and done with high quality.
So listen to your doctor's advice about that. You know, I had a cousin who died. She was in her mid-40s from colon cancer and had seemed very healthy. So I know this kind of thing does happen, even with no family history.
Yeah, and the most important thing there is that people who are below the age of 45 who develop symptoms that are concerning, the most important of which is rectal bleeding, need to come in for evaluations. Rectal bleeding often in younger folks is often related to something benign like hemorrhoids or fissures, but sometimes they indicate polyps or colorectal cancer. And so anyone with symptoms needs to come in for an evaluation. It's really, really important. That's how we can get to evaluate evaluate the folks who are younger than 45 who may have developed a polyp or cancer that we need to treat.
Because of the pandemic, are fewer people coming in for their regular screenings?
Yeah, another great question. And the answer, unfortunately, is yes. We saw a very marked decrease in colorectal cancer screening activities throughout 2020, and it translates into many fewer screening activities. And there are estimates now that lead that forward and can show that there'll be an increased rate of colorectal cancer decades from now because of the lack of screening now. The message that we want to get out is not to put off your preventative healthcare screenings because of COVID-19, but make sure that you continue to do those. Those include things like mammograms, pap smears, and of course, colorectal cancer screening.
Tell me about prevention. What are some things that people can do to try to protect their health and prevent this type of cancer?
The most important way to prevent colorectal cancer is to get screened for colorectal cancer, because the polyps, which are the precursor, those little polyps that can turn into cancer, are asymptomatic. So they don't cause any symptoms. And the only way to really detect them early is to screen for it. There are things that you can do as part of a healthy lifestyle that do seem to have a beneficial effect on preventing colorectal cancer. And those include being at a goal weight, so not being obese, and a good regular amount of exercise seem to both be protective in terms of colorectal cancer.
And you mentioned bleeding is a symptom. What are some other telltale signs and symptoms?
Unexplained weight loss is always a problem. Unexplained abdominal pain that persists. And we also recommend that anybody who knows that they have a family history of colorectal cancer, so for example, in a first degree relative like a parent or a brother or a sister or a child, should talk to their healthcare provider about their individual risk of colorectal cancer. They may need to be screened at an earlier age. The most important message here is that colorectal cancer is preventable, treatable, and beatable. If you want more information, you can go to the American College of Gastroenterology's website, gi.org/colon cancer.
That was Dr. David Greenwald. He's the president of the American College of Gastroenterology. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 18th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips. Here's the number, 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Eric Tegedoff, and Michaela Savitt. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us for the KBOO Evening News, and stay right here for KBOO News In-Depth coming up next.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Rural Oregonians who are frustrated with the state's progressive politics are taking matters into their own hands. County by county, these rural conservatives are petitioning for ballot measures which ask voters if they want to consider moving Oregon's border to form a greater Idaho. 5 eastern Oregon counties will be voting on this measure this spring. Supporters aim to become a part of a more conservative state without leaving their communities. They hope to adjust state borders so Idaho includes 19 eastern and southern Oregon counties and portions of several central Oregon counties. Eventually, they hope to include several northern California counties as well. Both the Oregon and Idaho state legislatures, along with the U.S. Congress, would need to approve this border change for it to be legal. But organizers are first trying to build support from the ground up, according to the president of the movement, Mike McCarter. McCarter is a resident of Lapine in Central Oregon.
We're taking it county by county because we want to see what the citizens think of those counties. Now, this started out with a grassroots movement of rural Oregonians, and it still is. But our goal was to hear their voice through the vote.
In May, Baker, Grant, Lake, Malheur, and Sherman counties will vote on whether or not their county commissioners should discuss the border change. Commissioners have no actual power over border changes, but can start exploring what this move would look like. In two Oregon counties, Union and Jefferson, commissioners have been doing just that. A majority of these counties' residents voted in November in favor of the measure. Now commissioners have been taking the lead in discussing issues like water rights, medical licenses, and reservations for Indigenous people.
I'm not trying to sell them on this. We are not trying to sell them on it.
Them is in reference to the county commissioners.
But what we are saying is that your people are frustrated. They want to see something happen and change, and they're voting that way. So it's up to the commissioners to follow through with it.
Last fall, similar measures were on the ballot in Wallowa and Douglas counties, but they failed to gain a majority vote. Following this spring's election, organizers aim to put measures on the ballot in at least 5 more counties for next fall's election.
It's just the broader the spectrum, the more the people that are involved in it and understand and speak out for it, the better the movement's going to go. Our elevator pitch is, you know, basically, are you unhappy with the direction that the Oregon legislature and the governor is taking? Do you think that rural counties or where you live is being represented, or they're hearing about your problems? Or basically, are they just dealing with problems out of the Willamette Valley where most of the population base is at? Then the question comes up, what do you want to do about it? Do you just want to sit and let it go on as it's been going on for 15 or 20 years? Or do you want to see some potential change? And so one of the changes that we're recommending is move Oregon's border. And it's county by county, asking the citizens to vote whether they want their county commissioners to start promoting and looking into the possibility of their county becoming a county of Idaho. So it's not necessarily putting down what's going on with the Oregon legislature right now. They're dealing with a lot of problems, and it's a lot of it's based around Portland, the metro areas, Portland to Eugene. But every time they pass a law, it affects us too in the rural counties. So we're just speaking out and letting them know that there is a problem here, and we'll see where it goes.
Organizers mainly communicate with supporters through platforms like Parler, Telegram, and Gab, and they have an email list with just under 4,000 subscribers. The Move Oregon's Border Facebook group, which had about 12,000 members, was disabled for election misinformation in January.
There was potentially some people that were voicing a displeasure with the presidential vote on our website. All of us administrators were clamped down on that as hard as possible and watching everything that pops up, because we're not a group that believes in insurrection. We are a group that believes in doing it the legal way. And that's why we jump through the hoops on petitions and voting and everything else there.
McCarter described the movement as a win-win-win situation. He said it's a win for both progressive and conservative Oregonians, as well as people in Idaho. If borders were to change, progressive Oregonians and conservative Idahoans could live in political bubbles without diverse views. But people like McCarter argue this border change is necessary to give a voice to rural Oregonians.
You're probably pulling a lot of the conservative Republican senators and representatives out of the state legislature. So all of a sudden, the new Oregon is a very super majority, Democratic majority. They don't have to worry about the potential gridlock that takes place if the Republicans walk out. So they can continue with the agenda that serves their constituents better. So nationwide, it just takes and moves one congressman, Congressman Bentz from Oregon into Idaho. So there's no change in the whole mix on a national level. So it's basically a large change statewide.
McCarter argues Idaho would also benefit.
Idaho they look at bringing in more conservative people, opening up their territories, opening up a landlocked state, all of a sudden their economy is going to take and grow.
Supporters hope that coastal counties such as Coos, Curry, and Douglas will become a part of the Greater Idaho. The Greater Idaho is the name of their movement, not a proposed name change for Idaho.
And the third win is the citizens in rural Oregon are aligning themselves with like citizens in Idaho. So it's a win all the way around. It just has to be looked at, talked about, and negotiated for it to come about.
According to McCarter, the Idaho government has a more hands-off approach than Oregon's. He says residents pay far less in taxes, and organizers are currently reaching out to colleges to do a regional and economic report on the impact of moving the border.
Basically, Idaho, when you start looking at them, even tax-wise or business-wise or constitutional-wise, they have a lot more freedoms. They have far less legislation over the people. So it is a freer type of lifestyle where the government is not involved in every part of your activities during the day. In Idaho, if a person wanted to carry concealed with a handgun for their own personal protection, at 18 years of age, they can start doing it and they don't even need a permit with it. So they are probably one of the best Second Amendment states that's out there.
What do people in Idaho say? Some worry that Oregonians are trying to change their state, but McCarter says this is incorrect.
We're not trying to do that. We're just trying to come alongside them because those folks in Idaho, their counties and our counties, tend to match up very well in traditional values. When you drive over to Eastern Oregon and head over towards Idaho, the only reason you know you're in Idaho is because they've got a big sign that says, "Welcome to Idaho." Landscape, agriculture, all of that tends to fit together.
McCarter said that both Idaho and Oregon state legislators have been interested in the idea and are watching the May County votes.
That vote is probably the key for the whole movement, the one that's coming up in May. It's very, very important because both Oregon and Idaho's legislators are watching it. And so it's we learned a lot on this last election. We weren't able to get into the voters pamphlet because we just qualified these counties right at the last minute. That hurt us as far as getting the word out about what was going on. And it's not a vote that a county wants to secede from the state of Oregon. That's not what it's about. It is about, we want them to start looking into the potential move from Oregon to Idaho there. But no county can secede from the state without the state legislature's approval. So that's not going to happen there until they approve it.
The movement's primary goal is to move Oregon's border. But its secondary goal is to get the Oregon legislature, which has a Democratic supermajority, to listen more to rural Oregonians.
It's a message to the Oregon legislature. Now, granted, we're only 25% or so of the total population of the whole state. I look at Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon kind of as a playground for the Willamette Valley. When people want to go play, where do they go? When they want to ski, when they go water, hunt, sports, or they go hunting or fishing, normally they come over the Cascade Mountains and play over here and stuff like that. Maybe the legislature will start to listen to rural Oregon a little bit better. And hopefully they'll understand how what they do in the legislature at times, the bills that they push, how they affect us over here. But right now, in rural Oregon, there's not a lot of trust in the Oregon legislature because we see it like a freight train. They have an agenda and they're pushing it and they've got the votes and so they're going to push it through.
McCarter is a fourth generation Oregonian, and like many supporters of the movement, he loves his community in Oregon. It's the state legislature he has a problem with.
I think that the state legislature, while it's in session right now, and the number of bills that they're trying to get pushed through does take and fuel our movement, whether it's good or whether it's bad. But I hopefully it causes people to look at what's going on and to be more aware.
McCarter often hears that changing Oregon's border is far-fetched, but he says that in this day and age, anything can happen.
I am totally amazed that the way this country has changed over the last 5 years. Who would have ever predicted that Donald Trump would become the president of the United States? Watch the way the COVID-19 took over things and stuff. It is amazing me of what the possibilities are. I see different states combining together on general ideas. You look at Oregon, California, and Washington, all the way along the Pacific coast. They've sort of banded together on it with like policies and things like that. So to say that this can't happen, I'm not going to buy that at all. Number one, if we don't try, how are we going to find out if it'll work? Who knows if Move Oregon's border will morph into something else? I don't know with it. But in the meantime, we're not going to sit still. We're going to continue to listen to the citizens of each county. We're going to take it to our legislators. We're going to talk to the Idaho legislators. We've already reached out to U.S. Representative Bence. He's aware of it and so on, that it's taken place. We want to open up the talk about it. It's not a battle. People want to create a war out of it. It is not a battle at all. It is the proper way for a representative government to work. The citizens should speak out when they have a frustration or a problem. And the state legislature should take and respond to it.
Supporters are pushing for a border adjustment, not the creation of a new state. Even so, McCarter knows it's a long road ahead.
We don't think there'll be an issue if it gets as far as U.S. Congress, because we're not adding any more U.S. representatives or U.S. senators. Same mix, just changing from one state to the other. So we think that would probably go pretty good. I would question, though, the fact that because there are other places in the United States that are watching us, that would like to do the same thing, whether or not opening that door by giving us an approval might be a problem.
One similar movement hopes to move parts of Illinois into Indiana.
But, hey, we've been blocked in several other ways and had to go to court and stuff like this. We'll just do what we have to do it right. But I tell the whole team, when we get done with this, when it's all over with, at least we can look back at it and say, honorably, we did it the right way, we did it according to the law, and we gave it our best effort. And if it doesn't work, okay, go into full retirement then.
That was Mike McCarter, the president of Move Oregon's Border, a conservative movement that aims to adjust state borders so much of rural Oregon becomes a part of Idaho. 5 Oregon counties will see ballot measures on May 18th to consider making this change. This is Hannah Merzbach with KBOO News.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19. So let's get started.
All right, welcome to Noise Filter. This is Dr. Mark Allen Derry. Doc Griggs is not able to be with us today, so let's go ahead and get started. The New York Times has an article centered around stopping myths about the vaccine and its relation to women, written by doctors from the Yale School of Medicine. Before we begin, we want to acknowledge that the huge toll of women have had to endure this past year in terms of career and home life. In addition, now some women are forced to be scared to take the vaccine because of rumors. That's right, rumors. Insidious, terrible, horrible misinformation and rumors on the potential issues with fertility and nursing children. That does not exist. There is no data on this. Those are, even reading this story makes me cringe because that just doesn't even exist. But okay, now early clinical trials did not include nursing moms or women that were pregnant, so we understand the hesitation, but many social media platforms have spread misinformation that the vaccine causes infertility. It doesn't, because antibodies target both the coronavirus as well as a placental protein called syncytium 1. That's wrong. It does not. There's no notable similarity between the two proteins. The vaccine is designed specifically for the coronavirus spike. There is no there. So doctors tested women who've had COVID-19, found no interaction between the antibodies from COVID and this protein that is on the placenta. There's also no evidence to suggest that recovered women have lost their fertility abilities, and many women have conceived children after having COVID and being vaccinated. So there. All right, that's real information. But my goodness, does this misinformation spread so much faster? Okay, what about breastfeeding? So with regards to breastfeeding, according to these doctors, women who get immunized both help the mother and the baby. So there's an advantage there. If a woman gets immunized, the idea is that the antibodies from the vaccine would pass to the baby through breast milk. If this happened, though unlikely, it would not be dangerous for the baby. The risks and benefits need to be assessed when deciding to get the vaccine. If a pregnant woman is unlikely to be exposed to coronavirus, then it seems practical to wait until after the delivery of the baby or until more at-risk people get immunized and we have more data. But in closing, other vaccines have been administered to pregnant women safely, and animal studies do not suggest that COVID vaccine would be any different. We also do know that pregnant women are at higher risk of contracting COVID-19, which poses potential threats to the health of the mother. So please don't underestimate the risk of COVID-19, and don't overestimate the risk of vaccines.
Vaccination startup scandal. In an NPR report, we learned about a group of college students looking to help with the pandemic. They began using their technical skills to make face shields and organizing a nonprofit called Philly Fighting COVID to open a testing site in a neighborhood without one. Their leader, Andre Dorishin, wanted to expand vaccination for the city. His marketing plan involving vaccinating local celebrities to persuade their fans to do the same. Okay, fine, I do that to a certain degree with things here in New Orleans. And Dorsha wanted to build 5 mass sites and 20 smaller ones throughout the city, potentially vaccinating up to 1.5 million people. He also explained that his nonprofit could bill insurance companies for administering the vaccine. So Dorsha ended up making an informal deal with the Philadelphia Department of Public Health and registering his nonprofit as a vaccine provider with the CDC. They did not receive funds, but received unofficial sanction, publicity, and part of the city's vaccine allotment. The mayor was hopeful that this would tackle the inequity in vaccine distribution and that this nonprofit would diversify the vaccinated. But it did not. After the first vaccine event, the nonprofit allegedly lost all racial and ethnic data for patients, blaming a glitch in their system. So WHYY reporters began investigating the organization and found that the group's logistics and promotion were actually not working. In December, they actually became a for-profit company, and other groups partnering with the group claimed to receive little or no notice for testing events, which hurt communities of color. In fact, at one point, the leader made a statement that he did not think testing was relevant anymore. And he made it clear he was not concerned with standard clinical protocols, ignoring technical questions about the vaccines. The organization also had scheduling issues. Anyone could sign up to be vaccinated, even if they weren't eligible. Many of their doses were canceled then upon arrival. Seniors were turned away because of booking errors. In fact, one volunteer said that the staffers told volunteers to call anyone to get the shot before they opened and saw Dorshin take a handful of vaccines and record cards with him in his bag. although Dorshin admitted to vaccinating just his girlfriend, but nobody else. A few weeks later, the city's having nothing to do with this organization, causing confusion for many thousands of Philadelphians, and many were now worried about their personal medical information, especially since the company's new private policy allowed for them to sell patient data. What? The city had options for other partners, including the four major health systems, and the health commissioner claims that he should have been more careful. Yeah, I would imagine. And now several state lawmakers are calling for his resignation. Look, this is a little bit of a blame. I don't think the health commissioner needs to take the hit here. Certainly, this group of college students started off with a very good idea and wanted to do something with the pandemic. Then, of course, once they started to get a little bit more influence and then they became a for-profit entity without really telling anybody, that's where everything really kind of went wrong here. And the bottom line is that these vaccines and vaccine distribution is not a game, and we need to get everybody vaccinated as soon as possible, and we definitely need to do it in the most equitable way possible. Let's swap out the candy for test. The Washington Post has an interesting article on coronavirus testing vending machines in Oakland, California, especially at the airport. The tests are $149, but can be submitted for reimbursement for your insurance. Now, this could be a quick and effective way to prevent transmission while traveling. The aim of the company that created this method, Wellness for Humanity, was to find easier ways for people to get tested. The test is mainly for arrivals because it involves spitting in a tube and shipping it back to the lab at Wellness for Humanity so it can be tested. Now, the results usually come back in 1 to 2 days. Now, this means that it's not really being used as a prerequisite for flying, however. Now, COVID testing has hit a plateau, and both scientists and this company believe making a more visible option can encourage people to test. The company has also pre-ordered pickups near their office in Manhattan and can ship tests to you. Future plans include opening 25 vending machines in the next 3 weeks and 1,000 in the next month. There are some other cool technological advances to help detect or slow the spread of the virus. The first is a bio button that sticks to your chest and uses sensors to track different things such as temperature, heart rate, respiratory rate, and things like that. Now, some healthcare systems are using this, hopefully, to distinguish the symptoms of COVID-19. Now, another would be the AirPop Active Plus. Now, this is a mask that can track your workouts and air quality. It tells you if your breathing rate, the quality of the air you have, or if your mask filter needs to be changed. Honorable mentions of masks include self-disinfecting masks and a reusable mask with a bacterial filtration system that still is in the works. Now, vaccination campaigns have taken over the conversation, which isn't wrong, but there still is the need to focus on testing and slowing the transmission of the virus until we can reach herd immunity through the vaccines. Many airports have facilities for on-site testing, but incorporating vending machines can only help people find quicker and easier ways to get tested. India's COVID cases have plummeted, and researchers aren't sure why. So in the early fall, India was seeing as many as 100,000 new cases of COVID a day. The crisis sent the country into a recession like it's never seen before. In October, researchers expected another spike as people gathered for the Hindu festivals. But the opposite occurred. Right around this time, daily COVID cases in the nation began dropping significantly. Now, only a few months later, the country reports about 10,000 new cases a day. Researchers aren't sure what the country may have done to do so well, and they're examining the nation's public health and cultural practices to see if it could be mimicked abroad. India does have a strict mask mandate. Police do hand out 200 rupee fines for those who violate the rule. It's about equivalent of $2.75. The country also prioritizes awareness, replacing the dial tones on phone calls with a message encouraging masking and hand washing by government officials and celebrities. India also has a hot and humid climate. While some researchers say otherwise, there's evidence to claim that this may reduce the spread of COVID. In a survey at the Punjab state, Georgetown University researchers found that 3/4 of patients did not infect any other person. 10% of cases accounted for 80% of infections, and the researchers are unsure whether this is related to climate or not. India's also a very young population. More than half the population is under 25 and less likely to be symptomatic when infected. Those in the nation who are elderly and at highest risk tend to be financially secure and have overall better health.
Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation.